Welcome to the CR Podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, we take a look at new content from the Center of Literary Publishing and invite editors and authors to read and discuss some of the work coming out of the center. This week, we'll be discussing an essay from the summer 2017 issue of the magazine. Hi, and welcome to the Colorado Review Podcast. I'm Lauren Matheny, one of the podcast editors. Megan Pipe is out of the office today. Today we're discussing some nonfiction from the summer 2017 issue of the magazine, and we're lucky enough today to have co-nonfiction editor Harrison Candelaria Fletcher and then our associate editor Michelle LaCrosse here to discuss the essay Daughter Tongue by Kathleen Blackburn. This essay was the winner of the 2017 AWP Intro Journals Project in Nonfiction and was selected by Benjamin Bush. We feel lucky to have been able to publish it in the magazine. And so today we'll be having a reading of the essay and a sort of roundtable discussion about what the craft elements of the work are doing and just sort of our overall impressions. Thank you, Michelle and Harrison, for joining me today.
Absolutely.
Glad to be here. Daughter Tongue by Kathleen Blackburn. On Guam, snakes hung from power lines. Hungry for birds, they stretched from grounded pole to live wire and died instantly. My mother was walking when she saw them, snakes on a wire, draped in loose coils like they fell from the sky. She used to imagine Guam crumbling in an unremarkable disintegration, a cloud of sand diffusing at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Waves like hands peeling the beach apart, splitting the island in two. The ocean a mouth, an esophagus. For some Americans, living in the Western Pacific is a suspension of disbelief, the uninterrupted dream of coconut palms and cerulean water as clear as glass. For my mother, it was a swell of peristalsis, the gravitational pull of an omniscient swallow, an unabridged nightmare. Even the island was shaped like a tongue. It careened in hunger. Guam was eating itself alive. My mother called it claustrophobia, which isn't inaccurate if we're talking about panic over the inescapable. I've heard a lot of stories about Guam, and none of them offers a way out. Perhaps this is why my mother told me stories of Guam in exchange for my silence, an implicit contract that whatever she told me in confidence would not be duplicated or questioned. Such has been the code of discretion between us. But surely a part of her knew that Guam was a harsh mirror, a pulsing river. When one looks closely, the story moves, it shatters. A part of me must have known this too, because I never told anyone what I've already said, what I'm about to say. She lived on Guam for less than 2 years, long enough to send a few postcards back to Houston, to start a family, long enough to establish a routine, get to the animal hospital by 8 o'clock, and by 9 o'clock begin vaccinating and palpating and prodding at the favored vertebra, yes, there, of the hapless pet dogs and cats of Guam's denizens, my mother's neighbors. Guam is only 30 miles long and 12 miles at its widest point, and the veterinary clinic was even smaller, the exam rooms cramped and muggy from nervous animal breathing. But one of the things about the American military is that the base checkpoint is a border you carry around with you. It vibrates out between the veterinarian, an officer's wife, and a Guamanian fisherman, even as he jokes about how much his dog likes beer, even while they both stroke the mutt to calm her. Like I said, my mother lived on Guam for 2 years, long enough to touch and go. In the evenings, she grabbed groceries at the BX on the way home. She rode her bike next to my father while he ran. When my father was away, flying weather recon in a C-130 called Ellen, my mother walked. Maybe she caught a glimpse of his plane in the sky. A silly hope, she might have thought, but she listened and watched the sky. She saw snakes. My parents were in love. I imagine my father pulled my mother in an inflated raft because she was afraid of the Pacific undertow. He splashed her and she covered her hair. But it is possible to love your husband and also be lonely. Zoom out. She was a white dot and the horizon curved around her. Remember how the ocean fucks with gravity? She might as well have been on the moon. In a white bikini and snorkeling mask, she grasped the raft's edges and plunged her face into the water. Satin reef, color jungle of angel, damsel, and parrotfish glittering in their full world. beyond the coral reef, ocean deepening to night. My mother told me that starving dogs foraged Guam's forests and alleys. The Naval and Air Force men and women who wouldn't or couldn't pay to have their dogs shipped to the next base abandoned them. They fed off waste, hassling with gulls at dump sites. Once, a neighbor woke to find a pack baring teeth at her back door. Always, they sounded like they were crying and fighting and eating. When she discovered she was pregnant with me, she kept me a secret at first. Doing so, she said, made me feel closer. Why do we tell the stories we tell? My whole life, I've said I'm from Lubbock, Texas, a place I know well enough to map by scent. Greece at Avenue Q, juniper at MLK, loam at the interstate. Beyond that, if you're lucky and it rains, shit and oil, another kind of mud. All this if you're heading east, towards the side of town where the people who built Lubbock live, the side of town that we're good at forgetting. It's not for nothing that just past the city's eastern border lie the stockyards with thousands of steer, the region's supply. Lubbock is a place trying so hard to be friendly that it refuses to be what it is, gritty, segregated, and unsustainable. Southwest Lubbock is a little harder to distinguish each block by smell. For miles, it's nothing but sawdust and concrete and exhaust. And Lubbock is mine to claim. My parents left Guam for an Air Force station in Lubbock in 1985 when I was one. My father retired from the Air Force 5 years later. When people ask me where I'm from, sometimes they say, I was born on Guam, but I'm from Lubbock. This is a kind of refrain, especially for children of the military. For most of us, we inhabit a place long enough to be born there or finish a few grades. Then we leave. But most of the time, when I tell the story of my origin, I say, I'm from Lubbock, and Guam vanishes, as though gulped by the ocean, as though I were never there. It means something to touch a place and then tell yourself that you left, to speak a story, a sentence, that erases your trace on a Western Pacific island. I never much cared for Guam, my mother often says. What does it mean to be born on Guam? What happens when I speak the memories that my mother gave me, open up the secrets that I've carried like talismans? Here's what I know. I was born at U.S. Naval Hospital Guam, where the island's northern limestone plateau slopes from 600 feet above sea level down to 200, and the mountains meet the forests. The year was 1984, and typhoon season was dwindling into November. Sumonsong in Chamorro, meaning to put in the stopper. My mother remembers no rain. Instead, she remembers the labor, an intense 13 hours, but not nearly as acute as what she thought was happening, my forced separation from her. I don't think she ever forgave me for this. She declined the epidural. Yes, she wanted to feel every detail of this offense. Another thing I know, silence can be simple. It can also be binding. Between mothers and daughters, there are codes. Ours has been one of silence. My mother told me stories of Guam, an inheritance. I'm not supposed to give this away, but I will tell you everything because it is what I have. I understand why my mother felt the island could break apart and sink. Our grip on the earth is tenuous. It can feel impossible to know if we belong anywhere. My mother said that the electrocuted snakes were Philippine rat snakes brought to Guam by the Marines to feast on the overpopulation of rats, but this isn't true. Listen, as I go along, things are going to change. This is what happens when secrets taste air. I once used to think that Guam was a volcano. During the Eocene, this volcano fumed at the bottom of the ocean and emerged when the Pacific boiled and the Earth's crust burst. But Guam was birthed when the Earth's floor slipped. The Pacific plate slid beneath the Philippine plate, such a simple way to describe an earthquake. The plates trenched, and magma that melted along the plate's edges sprung into a string of volcanoes. Refuse from these volcanoes gathered into a mountain on the western side of the trench to form Guam. So, Guam was not a volcano, but a volcano's aftermath, and beneath Guam, the deepest crevice in the world. There are two snakes. One exists in dreams, and the other on Guam. Both hung on wires like debris from another world. The first, the Philippine rat snake, was born in whispers. Some said the snake was carried to Guam by Filipino migrant workers hired by Brown Pacific Maxon, a company contracted by the Navy to build Guam into a fortress after it had been cratered in World War II. This is where the Philippine rat snake began, in the heart of racist rumors. Then the rat snake appeared again, this time in writing. The Marines filed a report stating that the Navy brought the snake to Guam to control the overpopulation of rats. The Philippine rat snake is responsible for the extermination of Guam's native avifauna, the report reads. Hold on to this detail. This is where the dream borrows from the day. The second snake is the brown tree snake. Thin-bodied and bulbous-eyed, doll's eyes some call it, native to Papua New Guinea, where they travel by night and dwell in tropical trees. Boega irregularis, their Latin name bounces on the tongue, the words as strange as the snakes themselves, mostly harmless to humans, yet capable of taking over an entire Pacific island. They spread like shadows, but are as deadly as fire. Because of the brown tree snake, there are almost no birds in Guam's forests. Though this sounds like a dream, like a nightmare, this is the real snake on Guam. In the quiet that followed World War II, U.S. war cargo corroded in the grips of the Papua New Guinea jungle. In 1949, when the Navy transferred the cargo to Guam, it unwittingly transported brown tree snake stowaways to the heart of the Western Pacific. Several brown tree snakes could have been curled up in well wheels or tucked under jeep seats, but with no natural predators, it would have taken only one pregnant female to populate the whole of Guam. No one noticed the snakes at first. Instead, they heard the forests going silent in a northbound diminuendo. Biologists froze in their porch swings, straining to hear the call of the nightingale reed warbler, the purr of the white-throated ground dove. The general thesis of the time was that the birds were ingesting something poisonous to their systems. The world was hip to the devastation of pesticides. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring had been circulating for 18 years, and the military had all but suffocated Guam in DDT in the 1940s and 50s. Some biologists believe that it was a mosquito-borne disease that had wiped out doves on Hawaii. That an invasive species, an animal, was eating all the birds was unfathomable. There was no known precedent. The snake spread from the south of the island like a penumbra, feasting on birds. Meanwhile, biologists looked for traces of DDT and disease in felled birds. By the time an avian biologist, a woman named Julie Savage, decided to dissect brown tree snakes, they had been on the island for over 20 years. Nearly all 13 species of forest birds were extinct. Savage found the tree snakes' bodies laden with birds. She published her report in 1984, the year after my parents arrived on Guam, when the last of the brindled white eyes were recorded there, yellow underbellies, bright green backs, rings of white around their eyes, intimating wonder, as though the white eye were a species of awe. At the height of the brown tree snake population explosion in the mid-80s, estimates suggest that there were approximately 40 snakes per acre on Guam. Why, then, was there a Marine report in 1984 about a Philippine rat snake? Why did my mother always suppose that the snakes were Philippine rat snakes? To this day, she believes it. Why do we tell the stories we tell? In the story of the Philippine rat snake, the military had a mishap. It brought over a non-indigenous snake to help control the rat population. Then the snake overpopulated. The story stays simple, like my mother told it. In a story like this, the motive is benign. The military has agency and stays noble, though naive. There are reasons that the Philippine rat snakes lives in stories about Guam. But what are they? How far back do I have to go? My mother was born in Houston, Texas in 1959 under a city-stained sky. Watery heat leavening the air to thick, invisible fog. The circumstances surrounding my mother's childhood are obscure but for these. She was the second daughter in a row of three. Her father was ex-Navy from Virginia and owned a paper goods company in Houston called Performance. He could slice you in half with one word. He could funnel the purpose of your existence into a single tributary of the desire to please. Her mother, Roanna, was 4 years old when she heard a firecracker pop in the den and found her own father dead. He had shot himself, but it looked as if his head had burst, the stain on his recliner like a finger painting of the sun. After that, Rowanna's mother gave her up, and the child went to live with her grandparents. This is how the family sprawled, like Houston itself, spreading to flee its own heart. Rowanna hardly ever saw her mother again. As an only child, she grew up with her grandparents. In high school, she bought a coat with faux fur lapels and cuffs, a ridiculous coat in Houston. My mother says Rowanna thought it was stylish. I think she felt like the coat held her insides inside, like another layer of skin. This was my grandmother, the woman who knew the body could fail to hold it all. She gave the coat to my mother. Marrying Jeff Edens, my mother has always said, was the worst thing that ever happened to her mother. She says the phone calls from the other women came often. Once, Rowanna threw all of Jeff's clothes into the front yard. Then she helped him carry them all back in. Rowanna smoked cigarettes, mostly in secret. When Jeff discovered them, my mother sat on the porch listening to Antonin Dvorak's New World Symphony to drown out her father's slaps, her mother's screams. My mother remembers the afternoon she came home from school and Rowanna beat her with a 2x4 that had a nail sticking out of it. She laughs when she tells the story because the nail kept puncturing her rear end and she pictures a cartoon, not herself, not her mother. But she was bleeding, and the blood was blossoming in geraniums on her shorts, thighs, and back. Her younger sister, Colleen, had to bite Rowanna's neck to stop the board from landing again on my mother's back. My mother doesn't remember that Colleen had to save her from Rowanna. Only Colleen does. The stories we tell are not always a matter of our choosing one version or another. But this my mother remembers in excruciating detail. One summer when she was a child, she found a dog. It was a terrier mix with white hair that yellowed at the ends and a swollen belly. She kept the dog in her bedroom. On the night the dog birthed 4 puppies, my mother became a doctor, cooing to the straining dog, wondering at the greenish placenta, the gel-covered pups with mice feet and sealed eyes. She emptied out the lowest drawer in her dresser and tucked the dog and her pups inside. The stray dog surrounded by soft offspring at her breast. My mother says this is why she became a veterinarian, but I know it is also why she became a mother. 2 weeks after the pups were born, they vanished from the drawer. Jeff told my mother he'd found a home for the dog and pups, but she understood, even as a child, that all 5 were dead. Here's what I know. By the time I was born, my mother was convinced that the world was cruel. A part of her knew, too, that anyone is capable of violence. But she also believed we could choose not to be. This is key. If you listen hard to the Philippine rat snake story, you can hear it. The belief that we are better simply because we want to be. It is a story that justifies the outcome because the motive was innocent. I will tell you what a man who lived on Guam told me. His name is Gordon Rada, and he's a zoologist who's been studying brown tree snakes and the vanishing birds since the 1980s. He said he wasn't sure why the military thought the snake had been introduced purposefully. But people are prone, he said, to impugn a purposeful motive to things they don't understand. Was it the vanishing of the birds the military didn't understand? Or was it the devastation of their own presence? Is this the same question? The same answer? The story of the Philippine rat snake is more than a story. It is a way of telling stories. It is a defense of an imagined innocence. This is what happens when I say, I was only born on Guam. This is an American tradition. And now, I'm grieved. My mother made a request in a language beyond words, a code that traveled in the arteries of the cord that once bound my body to hers. Before I was born, I learned our code of reticence. I feel as though I carried her stories with me when I entered the world. She expected me to keep our code. It was an unfair request, yet a part of me feels certain that when she asked for my silence, it was a request for protection. Until now, I thought the safety she sought was from the world that had been cruel to her, but I am also denying refuge from ourselves. So many of our myths are meant to protect us from the fact of our complicity. If my mother was wrong and we aren't better people just because we think we are, then one alternative is that we can't escape where we were born, which is another way of saying what we are. I was born on an American territory during the unprecedented degradation of a Pacific Islands ecosystem. The first sound I made was a breach. My mother once told me that she couldn't stand how I changed her words, twisting them into something new and ugly. Even now I hear her voice in my mind. You know what you are doing. I knew when she told me, as I do now, that she meant I was using her. The story of the Philippine rat snake is a lie about what happened on Guam. It's a cover-up for one of the worst devastations to an island's ecosystem in recorded history. It is a blatant request for acceptance, an entreaty for love. At first, I saw it fitting that my mother lived for a brief period on Guam. A children's book on the Marianas described the island's shape as a fish. I imagined my mother growing up in Houston, the humid air catching in her throat as if she were meant to drink it, as though she were evolving back towards the ocean. On Guam, temperatures lingered around 81 degrees, and because of its proximity to the equator, the ocean water was just as warm. My mother's world, I imagined, was so entirely amphibious. I told myself that it was fitting that I was born just as Guam's forests were quieting, that this was one of the reasons for my test's eternity. Silence begets more silence. I also thought that, on the other hand, my obligation to silence was the result of my mother's when she carried me. Ultimately, I toyed with the connection between Guam's muted forests and the code of discretion I've known my whole life. I like order, a story that resolves, an associative connection. But if I were wise, I would understand that there is no real relationship between the reserve my mother demands and the disappeared birds. And if this were a story only I could tell myself and my one-day daughter, I could resolve how we create silence when we colonize a place, when we occupy each other. It is the outcome, intended or unintended. I want the world to make more sense than it does. Like Dr. Rada said, I want purpose at least in the face of much more than I can or want to understand. I was born on Guam in 1984, but this story didn't begin there, nor did it start with the arrival of the brown tree snake or with the U.S. acquisition of the island in 1898, or with Spanish imperialism in 1521. In terms of invasion by imperialists, Guam's history stretches across 3,500 years, so perhaps the story begins when the first humans colonized the Pacific Islands, 3,500 BP. But beginnings suggest the start of something, and ecologists estimate that at least two-thirds of the Earth's prehistoric birds were extinguished by humans before European contact. Their estimations are based on fossil records for birds that we know existed and predictions for extinct avian species we have yet to discover, meaning that the 13 species of birds in Guam's forest were a vestige to begin with, meaning that when it comes to Guam, the dates above are not beginnings, but endings. Ecologists call them extinction events. They continue to collect fossils on Guam and other Pacific islands and use them to predict how many birds there are yet to discover. Their purpose is to estimate how many prehistoric birds vanished when humans colonized the Pacific. The point, in the end, is to produce a record that approximates how much we have lost. I find myself thinking of typhoons. 45,000 people were left homeless on Guam in 1962 after Typhoon Karen, and in 1976, the winds of Typhoon Pamela peaked at 240 kilometers per hour, eviscerating an estimated 80% of the island. My parents lived in a single-story, cinderblock house. Post-typhoon construction was soldered and bolstered with steel, like paperweights holding down green lawns and domestic life so that typhoons couldn't wipe it all away. I wonder if my mother knew much about Guam's typhoon history. Perhaps the intimacy she said she felt when I was a secret inside her had something to do with weight. Perhaps when she imagined Guam sloughing and drifting to the bottom of the ocean, she reassured herself that together, in storm or earthquake, we would reinforce our grip on the earth. While they lived on Guam, my parents made a home video for friends in the States. They are sitting on a brown and orange shag couch, flanked by cinder block walls. My father does all the talking. I am slouched between, a fat, sleepy, bald baby. My mother is wearing high-waisted shorts and enormous wide-framed glasses. She doesn't say a word in the video. Her face is turned away from the camera. She gazes at me. The video ends with a shot of the base housing. My father zooms in on the thin branches of a sumac tree in purple shadow by the front door. He tells us that a typhoon came through and blew away every leaf. The largest river on Guam has five names. The Banya flows from the southern mountains underground, where it becomes the Tolai Yuos, or God's Bridge. And though it is called a bridge, for several hundred feet the river drifts invisibly underground like an artery or tunnel, until it emerges and continues as the Maagas, before being renamed the Tenacha River at the old Sanyana Trail. The River of Five Names. The Tenacha River picks up momentum as it nears the shore. At the point where it forges with the Ugam River, it rushes into the Pacific as the Talafofo, its fifth and final name. Heraclitus was right. There are approximately 60,000 stray dogs on Guam. I imagine them perpetually searching for their owners, unable to comprehend desertion. The military families having done to the dogs what the dogs themselves, in their loyalty, were incapable of doing. The night when they showed up at our friend's back door, perhaps one of them believed she had found her way home. What connects me to Guam? I can't claim the island. It rightfully belongs to the Chamorro, whose story of man's beginning holds that humans originated from their ancient ancestor, Fu'unya, a woman who gave up her body for the creation of humankind because she was lonely. Fu'unya walked into the ocean at the southern tip of the island and hardened into rock, the legend goes. The tide pulls across her, and she dissolves into particles of sand that bore her spirit, which emerged as a people that either stayed or spread across the earth. When the first Spanish imperialists, led by Ferdinand Magellan, appeared on the horizon in 1521, and the Chamorro rushed out in canoes to greet them, perhaps they believed that their brothers and sisters had at last returned from an impossible diaspora. At that time, the Chamorro population is believed to have been about 50,000, but by 1710, after over 150 years as a Spanish penal colony and midway point on the Spanish galleon route, ravaged by epidemics of smallpox and tuberculosis, the Chamorro numbered 3,539. All of this before Captain Glass appeared, blazing his cannons in 1898 at the height of the Spanish-American War to claim Guam for the Americans. For a while now, I have been contending with a connection between the brown tree snake and myself. It begins as an image. The snake is curled up in the wheel well of a cargo plane aboard a naval ship porting at Apra Harbor, and my mother is in labor in the U.S. Naval Hospital Guam. In my mind, the image surfaces like a memory or a dream, of its own volition. It's a conflation of time, a forced connection, but like a bad dream or memory, I replay it. I watch, from above Guam, everything unfold. The brown tree snake glides away from the bay, and my mother gives birth to me. Maybe the image is an indulgence. If I can change the story, and the snake and I arrive at the same time, then maybe I can unthread the rest of it. Maybe this is the closest I can get to undoing the damage that's been done. But the image is also a refrain. It echoes. I brought the brown tree snake.
Thank you, Michelle. So, one of the things that I was really struck by in this essay was the structure of it itself. The kind of short, I said staccato paragraphs in my notes, playing piano, being a musician, just the short nature of a lot of these paragraphs and sometimes the words and the verbiage itself. I wondered if that related the staccato nature of it in some way to the author's concept of claustrophobia, which seems to sort of resonate throughout the whole essay. I wondered if you saw those concepts connecting at all, what you think that craft element of the short staccato structure is doing.
Let me ask you something. When you say claustrophobic, mm-hmm. do you mean that each vignette, each fragment is compressed? Is that what you mean?
I'm not sure. The whole... So in the essay, they discuss claustrophobia, her mom's claustrophobia on the island. And I saw that working. I think in my mind, I envisioned more the structure on the page as opposed to narrative elements, but just these like very boxy, the way it's constructed. But I think it could be taken lots of ways, or maybe it's the opposite of claustrophobia. I don't know.
No, I think that's interesting. Yeah, I think that there is definitely a compression with each one of the vignettes that, yeah, I took it as more the way memory works, in that it's fragmented, it's associative, and it's pieces that you're revisiting and trying to connect. Uh-huh. But I see what you're saying now is in that they're very tight. I don't know if kind of curious to see if you guys think they're airless in the way that claustrophobia suggests, because there's a lot of white space too.
That's true.
In between.
I don't know if I don't have claustrophobia, so maybe I've never had that experience. But I didn't feel airless in the reading. I think actually maybe the opposite, in the expansive nature of, because she's so quick to jump from idea to idea, that it seems, like you said, open space rather than boxed into one, maybe.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I see what you're saying. The claustrophobia is definitely mentioned throughout. If it were connected, mm-hmm. I mean, if it were a more linear, or if she tried to connect the vignettes, then I could feel the kind of closed-in vibe from the narrative.
Interesting.
I noticed two things when you asked that question. First of all, there are actually a couple of times I underlined sentences that seemed... they were fragments or very short sentences that didn't necessarily go along with the rest of it, especially on page 67, in the evenings, what her mother does when she's waiting for her father. A silly hope, she might have thought, but she listened and watched the sky. She saw snakes. And so for me, it were these little things where the theme kind of, I felt, of this paper was essay, secrecy and revealing, mm-hmm. and having this constraint to not tell. And so for me, these short sentences were her trying to break out of this habit of keeping these secrets. And so I also saw the jumping from idea to idea is her trying to figure out, how do I have a different type of, like, not life necessarily, but she says also in here that she learned how to be silent even in the womb. And so I saw this as kind of trying to break out of this pattern, but she doesn't know how to do it. And so she has these little sentences that kind of pop in, trying to, when we don't get a lot of background story because she's not comfortable telling it necessarily. That's nice. Kind of what I saw.
I totally get that. I like what you said, constraint. I do definitely feel a constraint because of the silence in the subject.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting, kind of an idea of non sequitur, when she's, you know, just going out and then suddenly bursts out with something that seems random. And yet, I thought the same thing. I marked sentences where I sort of said, where did this come from? And yet, at the end of the story, it all sort of wraps itself together. Do you think then that she's met the, if the objective is sort of trying to speak what she has never been able to speak, has that been met in this essay, do you think?
There are a lot of places where I keep asking questions. Why? From what? You know, is this a symbol? I'm not 100% sure that she has. I think it's an instance where she's reached a decision. I don't know if she's been able to realize it on the page necessarily. She asks a lot of questions that I don't know if she answers them by the end, but I feel the intention to try to answer them.
Sure. I would totally agree with that. Just getting back to the structure real quick, I mean, this is one of those essays that teaches you how to read it as you go along, and I think that she kind of references the structure a few times. One of them is like in the second paragraph on the first page, where she said it was a harsh mirror, kind of a pulsing river. The story moves, it shatters. I think that right there she's telling us why she's writing it the way she is.
That's lovely.
So, you know, the fragments, the edges, but also kind of the meandering, associative narrative. I mean, it kind of flows the way a river does, which is the fastest way to the to the sea. So it's I think that there are clues here throughout it where she kind of teaches us how to read it as we go. What were you saying? You just said something. I was gonna. Oh, that's a really good question. You know, the whole notion of silence versus, you know, speaking or giving voice to something, and does she succeed in that? I think that's part of one of the concerns of the essay. You know, one of the refrains she comes to again and again is, why do we tell the stories that we do?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my personal take, but to ask ourselves as we read this, what do stories do? What is the narrative for? Why do we use narrative?
Mm-hmm.
And, or what is a myth? And that is, you tell stories to understand things. That's how we human creatures make meaning of things. We make narratives of what we don't know, what we don't understand, what we're trying to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a definite tension between trying to find a narrative where none may exist. And does she succeed? I think her not succeeding is the success of the piece.
Do you think, so as you said, that line, why do we tell the stories that we tell, is echoed quite a few times throughout the piece. What do you think that echoing is affecting in throughout the structure of the story, either structure-wise, is it a reflection, as you were talking about before, of teaching us how to read the story?
I think it's from a craft standpoint, it's one of the things that makes it essayistic, is that there is the definite desire to figure something out, you know, a definite question that she's coming back to, you know, it's kind of a reset. It's not just that line, but she throughout the essay, like I said, or my mother told me, or this is what I know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real struggle going on that you could feel on the page of her trying to make meaning from her experience and, impose a narrative where there might not be one.
I like the grounding effect, I think, as you said, of those repetitions, just of reminding the reader it's easy to get lost in her. The descriptions of the snakes throughout this story are absolutely incredible. They seem kind of fever dreamish at the time. Just
sure.
The idea of seeing snakes hanging from power lines in itself is, you know, a little scary, a little fantastical. But then we're pulled back into maybe this, the route of the river.
I really
like that idea by these grounding phrases. A reminder that there is storytelling happening here. It's not just scene setting.
Right.
Dreamscape.
Well, did you guys, I would just ask you, did you find that there was a narrative?
I don't know. Yes, I'll jump in. For me, it was kind of a layering,
yeah.
And it's one of those deals, because for me too, I take into account, you know, I've grown up hearing the same stories over and over and over again from my mom, and for me too, as we get older, she'll add another element that maybe we weren't prepared for, like mentally, I'm not going to tell my child about, you know, these bad choices I made as a teenager, but I'll tell my teenager about these bad choices. So I see these layering, and it's this expanding idea. And so she's getting to this point where she's thinking, you know, when her mom says that she's decided to continue believing the story about the snakes coming from the Philippines, even though she knows the true story. And so for me, it was kind of this layering, getting to the point of, this is what I'm choosing to believe.
Right.
So I don't know that it was you could say it was a path, but for me, it was like going up step by step.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like what you said about family stories, because I actually think that this is very much, you know, a family story. And what's a family story? It's kind of like an origin story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we tell every family, I think, has kind of a story of who they are and how they came to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then why you would edit or not, because it messes with your identity.
Yeah.
So I think that might fit into the whole silence speaking issue that's going on. Yeah.
That actually feeds really well into one of the ideas I was sort of wrangling with when I read this, finished the story. So there's this central idea of a code of silence broken. There is a lot of, I think, guilt infused in this story of the narrator telling these things that she's sworn that she'll never give away. She discusses her mother's disapproval, saying, "I'm not supposed to give this away, but I will tell you everything because it is what I have." Mm-hmm. On page 69, and I think I read over that sentence 3 or 4 times trying to just process. I'm a fiction writer at Colorado State. By trade, I've done some essay work, but not a lot. So I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on how you personally, as an essay writer, feel that idea of sort, I don't know, maybe a duty to put something on the page because it is what you have, how that works in nonfiction work, how it works in this essay, or if you think it's something totally different.
It's interesting for me as someone who's just starting out rather than very established. I actually did have to have conversations with my family about, this is a thing that's happening now. I will be writing about you. Mm-hmm. I'm writing about me. But if I'm telling a story where, you know, my mom lost her temper and hit me or something, that's part of my story, but it doesn't put her in a very flattering light. Mm-hmm. So we had the conversation about, this isn't, but it's not about you, it's an honest portrayal, but it's my life story, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me in here when she talks about certain things, and for me, she alludes to a lot of things where I had questions. She adds the section about her grandmother, Roanna, and Roanna's mother. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, when I was first reading this, I thought, the only reason for me why it would be significant is if there was potentially a repeat mm-hmm. in her own personal life that she's not talking to, but by describing this, she's sparing her mother of perhaps talking about maybe there was abuse in her own household.
That's interesting.
And we can infer potentially that those are some of the secrets that she had been keeping. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in nonfiction, I do think it's something that every writer has to grapple with. Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. It's when you're writing about, I mean, nonfiction, you're writing about things that matter to you, people, events, memories that matter to you, and you can't do that without writing about somebody else often. The silence in this story is really interesting in that, you know, silence can be a control issue. It's like I'm asking you not to do something, so therefore I have exercised control over parts of your life. Mm-hmm. Someone once told me that your silence cannot save you. Oof. And that by keeping a secret doesn't mean that you're safe. And there's a, I mean, I could talk for hours about writing about the family, and probably often do, but, but I won't. You know, I guess the short answer is you own your own memories, you own your own stories. But what's interesting about here is that their stories are blurred and blended. Mm-hmm. And I would ask you guys, why do you think the reason was that her mom didn't want her to talk? I mean, you had mentioned violence, and there's hints of that. And what does that have to do with the snake?
You know, I think that idea of control is really fascinating because as writers, I think we understand, even as a fiction writer, a little bit of you goes into mm-hmm. everything, and people will perceive things are part of your life even if they're not. But everything is inherently, you see it as, oh, it's just my viewpoint of this thing that happened. Obviously, there's other viewpoints. But for a person who isn't in this world, I can absolutely see letting go of the control of your idea of a situation and having that be what is put out into the world is very scary. And a lot, it kind of eats away at your whole idea of who you are.
Exactly.
The structure you've created. And also, I think it goes into her experience on Guam was not a very pleasant one. And I think there's some idea of that time of her life is difficult for her to go back to. So why are we making a whole essay about it?
I think that goes to what the essay is, I mean, the theme of the essay, some of the things she's struggling with. I mean, I think a lot of it is about, and she says it at numerous points in the essay, but a lot of it is about invasion or occupation mm-hmm. or someone crossing into somebody else's space, invasive species, of which she may be one.
Absolutely.
And I think that there's a lot of wrestling with that.
Mm-hmm. And it's, as Michelle said, it is her story, but a lot of this takes place before she was, born. A twinkle in her mom's eye. So that perception, again, of how do you appropriate your family's story, the things we tell, the things we don't tell.
It's interesting you should say that, appropriating a family story.
Might be a more loaded word than intended, but...
Because it's weird for me at what point... because for so long you have these memories and you view them as a child, and so you don't understand the undercurrents, you don't know what came before, because all you can see is what's happening in front of you. But then as you become an adult, you start taking ownership over what happened. I feel like a lot of what she's doing here is this, in so many ways, telling her mother, I'm in charge of the story now.
That's interesting. Or
this,
Or telling her own.
Yeah, this happened up until now, but these are the things that informed my birth and my raising, and this is what made me be who I am. Mm-hmm. And now I'm saying, I'm going to say, this is how I got to this point. And she's taking ownership of these things that were...
Or trying to. I mean, that's kind of what the essay's struggling with. I mean, trying to put a narrative to something that she hasn't quite resolved yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. I mean, when a nonfiction writer uses imagination or speculation, as it does with this essay, it reveals so much more about them, their heart, their mind, their psyche, than it does whether or not the thing was true. And I guess my question would be, why is the writer doing that? Why is this writer going back and imagining things that she didn't experience? I mean, what does that say about her? What does it say about the essay? I mean, is she... doing what she's writing about? Is she crossing a boundary? Is she...
I think in some ways she is. I think she's kind of crossing the boundary between child and adult, parent-child, adult-adult interactions. She says here in several places. So number one, she feels guilt about not keeping her mother's secret, which can be... inferred that she no longer is under the control of her mother, so she's an adult, not a child anymore. She says that her mom, when she discovered she was pregnant, kept her a secret. So to me, her mom felt a very personal ownership over her daughter. And so I feel like she's grappling with this idea of the ownership is shifting from the mother to the self. And she feels guilt over that because she knows her mother loves her. And maybe there's other implied things. She sees herself as an invasion into the family unit, but perhaps her mother saw her as something else. And so coming to the grips of this idea, because she talks about her mom was very lonely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What happens when people get lonely sometimes? They have a kid.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I think she's grappling with this idea of who owns me, who owns my story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's great. I mean, by telling her story, she can help but tell her mother's too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of imagination and creation coming out of a need is very interesting in this story. In this essay. Old habits die hard. The why of why she's, like you said, going back and putting herself in the minds of these people. I'm not sure if I have an answer, but the fact that she's doing it in the first place, I think, is a really vital piece.
Sure.
Of,
I mean, a lot of it is imagination. A lot of it is mythological.
Mm-hmm.
As a fiction writer, does this read like fiction? I mean, or did you say, how is this an essay as opposed to a story?
No. I think a lot of the essays I'm drawn to and a lot of the fiction I'm drawn to blur lines in a way. I love Middlesex by Eugenides, and I think a lot of that has the sort of elements we think of in essay. But I sort of think when it comes down to it, it's all storytelling, and just the way you decide to tell might be more truthful than truthful quotation marks that you can't see on podcast. But... No, I never felt like I was delving into fiction. I kind of just went with the style she'd chosen, which I think shows success, that I didn't find myself often going, where am I?
Yeah.
Why? Why the snakes?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I love it. I mean, again, I think that she's inventing her own language here.
Yes,
which I love.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
And there was these interesting language juxtapositions I found really fascinating. Kind of on purpose, these jarring juxtapositions of images or sentences, mm-hmm. and why the writer might be doing that. It's like someone who is grappling with language, grappling with, as you were saying, trying to find words for something, things that are coming out, blurting out almost.
Mm-hmm. I think sort of the intense imagery of this piece is a nod to, as you were talking about, the difficulty of trying to express these things that you don't even know how to express. How do we do that as authors? We come up with a really, really, really striking image, a really striking element of craft, of wordplay, whatever.
Yeah.
We kind of get to be magicians with that, which is exciting.
It didn't feel forced to me. You know, usually when, you know, we see the snake, it says in the snake didn't come up, M for metaphor. This is the giant metaphor. I mean, what I loved about it is you could really feel the writer struggling with to make sense of this image, which I was going to ask you guys how you read the snake, because it changes throughout the essay. The meaning of the snake becomes so many different things, which is what I thought was great.
I wonder about the snake a lot, and partly because it does change so much. I mean, especially in the sections where it is very technical. It happened on this year, and this place, and this thing happened.
The history.
It's very factual. It is not mythical at all, and yet it still connects to that mythical, those segments of, you know, this is me, and these are these origin stories, and all these things, you know. I don't have a strong answer about that, because I definitely, it means a lot of things, and I'm struggling to pin it down.
I think the snake does so much work in this piece that it's, and I'm kind of in awe of her ability to do that. But just as when I was first reading it, I thought, oh, snake, regeneration, rebirth, okay.
Right.
And then we got further, and I thought the snake is that concept of invasion. We were talking about the snake isn't however many snakes per square mile and whatever gross ratio that was. So the idea of invasion, invasive species, just
right.
So as you said, it just develops and develops and snowballs. But I also agree with you that I never felt bashed over the head with, like, oh, yeah, the snake is back.
The snake changes from being, some Garden of Eden type thing, you know, dying as it goes to swallow birds, you know, or does it represent some kind of violence or some kind of darkness, some kind of hidden presence? Does it represent the military? You know, it represents, at some point in the essay, it almost represents all of these things, which is why I think it works.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I mean, I did a little research. I looked her up because I thought this was terrific.
Uh-huh.
So I found a couple of interviews with her that said some interesting things. She purposely tries to, she said in an interview, I can't remember where it was, she purposely tries to juxtapose elements, either something that's personal with something that's impersonal, just to see what tensions that produces. So she'll try to, as you read in this essay, she'll put opposites often together to create a certain tension and to kind of encourage a meaning there. We try and connect the two. And she also said that she was told to write like a house on fire, and also to get out of your own way, she was told. And she translated that into trusting the strangeness of her own writing brain.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. I think you can really see that at work here, how she really trusts the associative language, images, and the path that she makes meaning.
I think to play that game of putting the two things that are complete opposites together, you have to be, and not just playing it as a, like, well, this is, I'll toss it out afterward. It might be generative, but actually sitting down and writing from that takes a lot of trust.
Sure.
Trust in yourself and trust in your subconscious, even, to put things together, disparate events together.
Yeah.
Is that something Is that a sort of exercise that you would say is common for nonfiction writers to play with, putting disparate things together? I don't know. I'm just fascinated by if that's something you set out to do, if it just kind of coalesces.
I think it's kind of both. There are certainly times when I try it with varying degrees of success. Mm-hmm. I think, always. You know, this is something interesting that's an element of this. Perhaps my problem is I'm not trying to think about the significance. I just think of two things that are interesting, mm-hmm. especially when I'm trying to come up with like three, so my one personal thread, then the thread of the thing that happens, and then something that's interesting that kind of combines the two. Mm-hmm. I don't know how well I do that, but sometimes I'm just writing a story and then I'm looking at my paragraphs thinking, you know, this could be its own section here. Mm-hmm. So they're already connected. Sometimes I try to write them separately and connect them together. But yes, trying to find something that's very universal to put against something that's very, very specific and personal. I do try to do that.
And I would say, why? I mean, ask yourself why. I mean, you know, when you're right, this is, and then she's taking a thing like the snake and she's examining it from all angles to draw a larger meaning out of a thing or a feeling or a place or an idea. But, you know, you put different things next to each other to draw emphasis or contrast. And she did that. For instance, you mentioned the research element. Sometimes research can be a good springboard or a good sounding board.
And you've said to us before, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. So you're always trying to build something greater than what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
And in these kind of essays, no. You know, if there's not like a cause and effect structure, there's usually an accumulation of meanings, or there's like a emotional progression as opposed to a linear progression or a sequential or a cause and effect. So with this piece, was there, you know, we asked at the beginning whether she was successful in trying to put a narrative to this. You know, do you think that she, was there a shift in awareness from beginning to the end?
Absolutely. He said emotional awareness more than narrative. I think that resonates much more strongly with the story. And then the idea of personal and impersonal, because even in the specificity of this, which there's so much power in specificity, that's something that's drilled into our heads as writers. But the universals of this story, of the feelings that she evokes, partly through imagery, partly just through emotion on the page, I think that's really what brings you to a different vista at the end than you started at.
I mean, no, she didn't put it in a tidy bow at the end, but I mean, that's what I'm saying. In this particular instance, that's not required. So if somebody says, you know, did she have her, you know, light bulb moment and, oh, now I know what I need to do. No, you're not going to get that in this type of thing, but that's not, in my opinion, her purpose in writing this. She didn't want to have an epiphany. She wanted to wrestle with some things and come to some sort of
new place,
or for me it's an ownership at the end. I feel like she's kind of owning it, whereas in the beginning she's not so sure she does, and so there's not a resolution, but there's like more purpose, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she comes as close as she's probably going to get, you know, here at the end. You know, this is the closest I can get to undoing the damage that's been done.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's honest. I mean, that's authentic. She may not have made sense of the whole thing or found, you know, she forced a connection, she said, but that's as close as she could get to repairing the damage of, you know.
What a fabulous discussion. I always feel lucky to sit with people who know what they're talking about with nonfiction. Since it's a whole new world for me. Thank you so much, Michelle and Harrison, and thanks always to Kathleen Blackburn. This story can be read in the summer 2017 issue of the Colorado Review, and come back to visit us next month. We'll be working on another podcast for you. Thanks so much for listening in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found at iTunes and at the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next month.